you put toys on the cable or use one of these isolators. You're right, the best place is at the antenna. But some people will run coax, say they have a horizontal beam, they'll run the coax horizontally away from the beam, so the coax is in the same plane as the elements of the antenna, so there's a high coefficient of coupling. In that case, it's good to put an isolator at the antenna and one down just before it goes into the shack. Back to net.
Okay, so Don, good suggestion there, Rich. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, being that you're mentioning names, the question was about these toroids, and they are also available from MFJ. MFJ has the break-apart toroids that they sell very reasonable. Okay, I wasn't going to really get into that, but all right, I'll say a few words about it, and that's it. A friend of mine, been a ham, he says, for many years, he said to me, if I should spend the extra money, if I want to do the ground system right and use stainless steel pegs for ground rods rather than copper clad rods, do you agree with this and why? I give you a couple of pointers on that, but I see what maybe he's referring to, Dick, about, copper supposedly begins to lose its effectiveness in a number of soils, and you've got to, constantly, either rotate them, clean them up or whatever, and stainless steel pegs to, supposedly prevent loss of efficiency from corrosion. I don't know. I have a number of stainless steel, copper clad rods driven down, and I don't seem to have too much problem. Also, he asked, what is the proper spacing? Well, I have them spaced about 6 feet apart or so, random spacing, and they are all basically my system. I have number six wire that wraps around each one of the rods in a sort of a back and forth configuration where it terminates at the power base, and all the connections to the copper rods are not clamped. I braze with each one of the rods. That's the way I did it. Everything is basically buried, so there's not a trip hazard here, of course, in the backyard because it's underneath the lawn. That's basically my system, Dick. I think I have eight rods in my system. Each rod is, I think I used the 12-foot rods when I put them down. Yeah, I used the 12-foot, those were the commercial rods that are used by a number of commercial communications companies. That's basically my system. So I guess with stainless steel, I don't know. I haven't had the experience, maybe you have, with stainless steel ground rods, Dick, over.
Yeah, I just had a very recent experience on that subject. When it comes to a real ground rod in the ground, and the definition of an IRE ground rod, or is it I'm trying to think of the name of the organization that defines these things. They want it to be a 5/8 inch diameter copper clad rod or copper rod or galvanized rod, 8 feet long, with the right kind of a clamping device on the top. They wanted to have a 6-gauge piece of wire going over to the thing that's grounded, like your tower, and they want that wire to be below grade so that people don't trip over it for other reasons. I've only got, you've got eight of those, I've only got two of those in my system. But there's a catch. My towers have 12 guy wires at four different altitudes, three wires, so I've got a total of 12 wires. Each one of those wires is a quarter inch high-strength EHS galvanized steel, which goes into a screw anchor in the ground. The screw anchor is a 1-inch diameter galvanized rod with an 8-inch diameter Archimedes plate on the bottom and a great big eye at the top. And that rod is, I think, 5 feet long. I'm not positive on that right now. But each one of those rods is sunk right to the point where the eye is right at grade level. That gives me the maximum holding force. So that 8-inch Archimedes plate, 1-inch diameter rod, 5 feet down into the ground, and I've got a total of 12 of those going to 12 separate guy wires going through the tower. So my tower is grounded at four levels, three wires per level, total of 12 grounding rods. That's where my ground comes from. Now, I put those up not for grounding reasons. I put up those guy wires to make sure the tower doesn't fall over. But simultaneously, they're producing a beautiful ground. And if you look at them with a radio eye, you could say each of these three guy wires at each level of the tower is kind of a, like the three radials you've got coming out of the bottom of a superstation master antenna. So I got these four cones coming off the tower, so to speak, skeleton cones, going down to Earth to these screw anchors. I've lived here since 1969. I'm on the top of the local hill, a 300-foot hill, and I've got 100 feet of tower on top of that hill. And my trees are only 85 feet high or tall, so I'm the tallest thing around. I'm the local lightning arrestor for this community. And I only know of one occasion in 1969, that makes it 38 years that I've lived here, I only know of one occasion in which I'm pretty sure the tower was struck. The only damage I have ever suffered in 38 years, lightning damage, is damage to the television set and to a computer because of the impulse that came into the 110-volt line because lightning struck somewhere down the street. And so you can see why I've got the equivalent of a miniature local Eiffel Tower or Empire State Building in my backyard, a miniature version of it. I'm the tallest thing around. You would think I'd be struck with lightning all the time. And it's the power line that's the only thing that's ever really been struck that I know about. And that power line that did get struck on one occasion, one of the wires in the house got fused open from one of those strikes. So lightning is a funny thing. I'm hearing tell that the Polyphaser company no longer sells that lightning manual that I bought from them for $20. Beautiful manual. Maybe their legal beagles told them to stop doing it because somebody's going to get a lightning strike and get some damage and sue them for saying that there's not enough good information there. The book makes it clear that no lightning protection system is perfect. I read somewhere today that the average lightning bolt consists of 10 coulombs of charge. That's a lot of electrons in a hurry. It all occurs in 20 microseconds, so we're talking about numbers that can approach easily 50,000 amperes during a lightning strike. And that can do damage, even with protection. The protection will protect you from a lot of local, nearby lightning strikes, but you get a direct strike and one of those really big positive cloud lightning strikes. Most of the time, the bottom of the cloud is negatively charged, and it gives you a nice lightning strike. Once in a blue moon, a cloud will come along with positive on the bottom. Those particular lightning bolts are 10 times stronger and 10 times louder. You've all seen that kind of a lightning storm that you get once for 10 or 15 years where each one of those lightning bolts is super loud. Those are the positive lightning bolts. And boy, can they do damage. And can they electrocute you. So, these coils of cable will protect you from lightning to some degree. The ferrite isolators, the clamshell things, will give you some protection. Local grounding rods will give you quite a bit of protection, properly installed. That 8-gauge, correction, 6-gauge piece of wire that's supposed to come from the grounding rod to the thing you're grounding should be below grade with as few bends as possible, straight as you can get it. Now, because a galvanized grounding rod or a copper-clad grounding rod will experience some corrosion, it is very tempting to use stainless steel instead. I do not recommend that. I recently discovered, and you go to the reference data for radio engineers, or the SAMS book, or whatever it's called, and you find the page of resistivities of metals, you'll find that gold has got a number of 2.2, copper has got a number of something like 1.3, and silver is 1.1. The units happen to be micro-ohm centimeters, but just remember the number. Something like 1.1 for silver, something like 1.3 for copper, 2.2 for gold, 90 for stainless steel. It's very easy to look at the place called iron and you say, iron and stainless steel, they're close. Iron, as I remember, was 9.5. Stainless steel is 90. Stainless steel is a little bit lower in resistivity than nichrome wire, the stuff you make wire-wound resistors out of. So, although it's good on corrosion, do not use a stainless steel grounding rod, in my opinion. Much too high a resistivity. It's a series resistor. A good grounding rod system, you'd like it to have 1 ohm. And even with 1 ohm, connection between where you make contact and the way it makes contact to earth, even with 1 ohm, with a 10,000 ampere lightning bolt, 1 ohm, 10,000 amperes, means it's going to be 10,000 volts of drop right across that grounding system. It's a lot better than the megavolt that will happen if you don't have the ground. But even with 1 ohm, you'll have 10,000 volts of drop if you get a direct strike. And now you're going to use something 90 times greater than that? I strongly don't recommend it. K2KEY, K2LIW in the tech pad.
Pretty good. It says K2KEY, very good. And so just stick to the old copper-clad rod, you can't go wrong. Yeah, I have the same situation here. My tower is the tallest thing around here, so it is sort of, like you say, a lightning rod that protects the area. And it's been hit. We've got hit, in fact, once, three times in a row. Sometimes these storms come right in here off the ocean. I remember I'm only a few hundred feet here off the Atlantic Ocean. And it's a situation where I have the ground system, I could say, all bonded together, and then I also ground to the well. I have a well line that goes down, that's the sprinkling system for the lawn. It's a well pump system, and that pipe, it goes into the ground 36 feet down. And all the joints were brazed as I put the joints on driving it. I just put a weld across them, electric welded the pipes all together at the point where the unions, couplings, not unions, they're couplings. And then I grounded also to the cold water system. That's basically what my ground system consists of. But I will give you a word of caution. Do not take lightning granted. That, well, I got supposedly a foolproof ground system. No, you don't. As Dick just alluded to, you're dealing with immense amounts of power and concentrated. What I have on top of the tower is my porcupine. That's a piece of pipe that goes up above the top beam. This is a pin. It's a stainless steel piece of, at this point, it was a sharp piece of steel that I actually, was a nail-like device made out of, I believe, stainless, because it's, so it doesn't rust. And what I have is sharpened it to a point, to a sharp point. So if lightning does strike, it strikes this point first, which is the highest thing up there. But because it's such a fine point, it actually desensitizes the area. In other words, makes the lightning bolt have to concentrate to a very fine point, reducing, basically, I guess, the current. And I seem to have had a lot of success with that. I also caution everybody, do not leave your rig connected to that antenna when lightning is about. It don't take much to kill that radio, especially the radios of today. They're not like the old radios, but maybe a little bit more forgiving with the tubes in them. These are solid-state circuits, and some of these solid-state circuits, and they're so static-sensitive that you can actually, if you're working on it and you're at the workbench in your basement, be careful. You should actually do, you know, ground yourself. In fact, they did an article in QST about, ground kits and all when you're working on a lot of the new equipment, microprocessors and all that. That you can kill it right there on a bench or damage it and then have trouble very shortly after that. Don't blame it on the, sometimes on the radio. If you've worked on it, that you may have done the damage and not realized it. So disconnect that. Now, also what I do is when I pull the switch in the radio room, as Dick said, about AC lines getting the lightning damage. When I pull my fixed switch on my radio room, when that switch goes down, the wires that go to the rig, the power goes to the rig, goes to ground. And the AC lines, in other words, are completely, both the neutral and the two 110 volts of my 220 line system in there, are both isolated from all the amateur radio equipment. I've got quite a bit of equipment, more than I should have, I think, in that room. So this way I isolate everything from the AC line, and the rigs are never left connected to the antenna system. So basically, this is the layout. Dick, you want to put any more words on this before we go ahead? Over.
Sounds like a pretty good layout, Mel. I'm a little bit more risky than you. I haven't generally, over the years, disconnected all my coax cables from the rig when lightning comes. Maybe I've been lucky. And I don't unplug the rig. I should, but I don't. And again, maybe I've been lucky. The one thing I'm going to add is make a little bit more of a Faraday cage. I mean, there's a way that I can run a horizontal wire across my backyard, and everything under that will be inside of the cage, so to speak, and be in a grounded structure, including my house. So I'm going to be running a wire and two grounded points that goes over the house, just to make sure the house can't be struck. But when you study the polyphaser book, you'll notice that the lightning itself moves in 50-meter jumps, 50-meter zigzags. And so when it comes to a grounded structure like the tower, the guy wires, and things like this, if you take a spherical object, in your brain, you take a 120-foot diameter sphere, I think it's a 60-foot radius sphere, and you pack it in as tight as you can to the tower, the guy wires, and so on. Inside of that is a protected area. Lightning, most of the time, will not go there. It goes outside of that because it sort of avoids grounded structures. Also, his upside-down metallic broom is another very good way of discharging a local lightning cloud. Buy yourself, if you want to do some experimenting with high voltage, buy yourself a Van de Graaff generator. It's one of these ball-shaped objects that's on a great big plastic pole, and it can produce 200 kilovolts, 300 kilovolts. And you shine up that ball just right, and you put another ball alongside of it to be the discharge device, and it'll make a spark jump 5 or 6 inches. Put the tiniest little straight pin. Mount a straight pin in a piece of clay on the top of that round sphere of a Van de Graaff generator. Instead of it being able to generate a spark that can jump 5 inches, you'll barely be able to get it to generate a spark that'll jump a 16th of an inch. It's a very eye-opening experience. Just take one simple straight pin, mount it with a piece of clay with the head of the straight pin down and the sharp point up, and put it anywhere on the ball of your Van de Graaff generator. You will not see what it's doing, not even in a dark room. But the corona discharge that's occurring from the top of that one single needle will be short-circuiting your Van de Graaff generator, and instead of it being able to generate a voltage that can generate a spark, that can make a spark 5 inches, it'll barely be able to go a 16th of an inch. And what's really strange is the grounded discharge wand that you've got, which is another ball that it normally jumps 5 inches over, put the straight pin on it instead, and you get almost the same effect. You put the sharp pin on the grounded ball, and the Van de Graaff generator, its smooth ball is nice and clean, and you would think, hey, it used to jump 5 inches. Now with the shop pin in some other direction on the grounded ball, you'll barely jump half an inch. So you even put a shop point on ground that's anywhere in the vicinity of a high voltage generator, and it discharges it.
How about 2 shop points? Would that help at all?
For all I know, 2 would, in the case, if I put 2 shop points on the grounded one, I'm guessing the half inch would go down to a quarter inch. But if I put 1 single shop point on the main positive terminal, it can just barely reach a 1/16 of an inch of spark. Just one does it. So when it comes to an upside down broom, the ones that I've seen that are, you know, a conservative design, I've got a whole lot of broom hairs to it aimed straight up into the sky. But they do a beautiful job of discharging the local cloud of voltage that's starting to build up. I think it will primarily kill your leader stroke that precedes the lightning bolt. And I think a hell of a lot of the lightning bolts that normally will hit you will not happen with that structure. Barry, you also live pretty close to the water, and I wonder what kind of lightning you've seen strike your tower. N2 Moondown, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, and this is N2MB. Actually, I've had several lightning strikes over the years, and I've had some pretty interesting results. Most of the big strikes I've had were not on the tower at all. They were, like yourself, they were on the power line. And I've lost quite a bit of equipment because I didn't unplug it from the power line. A lot of people protect their radios on the antenna side, and I have done that, and only to find that the lightning strike is not coming that way. It's actually your local power line getting hit, and that's what's happened to me. I've lost a lot of equipment that way, and a lot of things in the house. I lost a refrigerator. We had the whole back of the house got disconnected once. I found a connection in the ceiling that actually, it actually burned open, and this was a power line strike, of course. I think I've had strikes on the tower itself. I had one where I'm pretty sure it was a lightning strike directly on the tower because the pipe for my rotator, which goes through a metal sleeve, actually fused to the metal sleeve. And I had a prop fish motor up there, a very powerful motor, and I had to rock it many times to break it free. I did, of course, eventually break it free, but that was pretty interesting when that happened. I've lost a lot of preamps, and they're pretty delicate. I tried many ways to protect them. I never was able to actually protect them. So these are problems you're going to have. If you disconnect everything, power line, antenna, I guess you'd be okay, but I've never had the foresight to disconnect the power lines, and I'm starting to think that's the bigger problem. K2RW and 2MB.
Yeah, both you and Mel live near a seashore, and that makes the problem considerably worse, because a lightning storm coming across that sea, getting to land the first time, and it sees your structure or Mel's structure, it says, aha, boy, that looks desirable. I'm 15 or so miles inland. I'm close to the center of the island, although I'm a little bit closer to the North Shore in Huntington. And you don't get as many lightning storms coming in off of the Long Island Sound, which I'm closer to, but I'm 10 miles from it, 8 miles, something like that. And I'm probably more like 15 miles from the South Shore, where storms are more likely to come in from. Our prevailing wind here is from the southwest, and so both you guys are on the South Shore, close to the water, and you're one of the first targets that storm sees as it comes off the water and starts hitting land. So you guys got to be a lot more careful than I do. I'm getting away with a lot more that I shouldn't get away with. And yeah, to be on the safe side, there should be a master switch disconnecting the rig and or unplug the rig. Okay, go to the next email if you want to, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Gotcha, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I seen lightning when it came down the AC lines, and what if this is in a house? It's a burnt wall and the exploded outlets and all. It was really something, tremendous damage to this one house. I didn't believe that when I saw, I mean, besides everything electrical, in a house was destroyed. The whole electrical house system in a house literally was destroyed. It just went right through the place. And a tremendous amount of physical damage in the house. So I guess the way lightning happens to, you know, pick that particular situation, you never could be too smart with it. So I'm a firm believer, get the antenna disconnected from the radio and get the AC line disconnected from the equipment. And that's what I've been doing. Considering if there's going to be a storm or not, I never leave without, when I'm finished with the equipment, this is my procedure, disconnecting everything, and I feel better because of, I'm out working somewhere. When I was out working, not much I could do if all of a sudden a storm's coming up, and I say, oh my God, I didn't disconnect anything. I mean, I just couldn't make it home that quick. All right, that's that. So, let's see now. All right, hey, here we go. Here we go back to the Balloon with an N. Balloon. Better known as Balance or Unbalance. But, all right, Balloon. Okay, what does this guy say to me? Okay, his name is Phil. Okay, unusual name. Phil. Where do I get a, or how do I make a 12-to-1 balance? Why do I need one? I figured out that, there we are, I'm trying to understand. Okay, I'm feeding my dipole, with 600 ohm line. Now, wouldn't I need a 12-to-1 balance to bring this into the Radio Shack to join up with my 50 ohm coax? I'll give the reason why I say no, because I don't think you're going to have a situation with the 600 ohm line. Basically, as Dick said earlier, if the dipole, say, let's say is up, 80 meters, on 80 meters the dipole it is, said with the 600 ohm line, yeah. And it's about 35 feet up, you say, well, let's see. I would say the resistance at resonance of this dipole is going to be somewhere around 40 ohms or so. Because the resistance depends a great deal on the height above ground in wavelength. So if you take this dipole and feeding it with 600 ohm line, and it's a halfway length long dipole on 80 meters, about 120 feet, you should see somewhere, say, around, off the top of my head, 40 ohms. And you got to remember that the halfway line represents, repeats itself at the other end. So if it was a quarter wavelength, long, you'd see, about 8,000 ohms. So at other line lengths, you'll see impedance somewhere between, in other words, at extreme. So in a case like this, I guess if you went and put a 4-to-1 balun, it would do the job, and not look for this 12-to-1 balun. I don't think you're going to find one so easy. So I would say a 4-to-1 balun would work most likely put it into your antenna tuner, and it should work out fairly well if that's the way you want to go. I mean, that's my opinion, Dick. Does it sound reasonable? Over.
That's one approach, Mel. Now I'm going to give you another approach. And by the way, I looked up Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. At the bottom of his first page of his website, which is labeled A Domain for Microwave Amateur Radio. Don't be scared by the word microwave. He's got some non-microwave articles down there on the bottom of the page, which I'm going to go to right now. And there it says Yagi Impedance and Matching Info. The second item from the bottom of the page. When your dipole on 80, 40, 20, 15, 10 meters, your HF dipole, is some particular altitude above the ground. You go to the appropriate chart in the antenna handbook, ARL antenna handbook. It'll tell you what the new impedance of the dipole is because of altitude. And in the past, people thought, boy, that's a big thing, changing the impedance of the dipole. By my standards, it's small. Yeah, the impedance can go as low as 30 ohms and as high as 120 ohms. Numbers like that. Not huge. If you're willing to adjust the length of the dipole, I can easily make the resistive component 600 ohms on the nose. Resistive component. By making the dipole longer than halfway. On 10 meters, that's easy. I will admit that you might not want to do that on 80 meters, because on 80 meters, the pure half-wave dipole is already 133, 135 feet long. And if you've got to make it about 50% longer to bring it up to 600 ohms, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I can go to the curve and I can find out. That's in this Tom Williams website. To make it 50% longer makes your 135-foot dipole look more like 180 or whatever feet long. And the average guy does not want to go there unless he's got a lot of property. So on 80 meters, you're not likely to use this phenomenon. But on any of the other bands, if you've got enough real estate, you're willing to make the dipole longer. You can make the dipole itself a perfect impedance match to 600 ohm line. I'm talking about the center of the dipole will be 600 ohms resistive. When you make it that extra length, yes, I'll admit it's going to be inductive. And you're going to have to put a shunt capacitor across the center. You can use a doorknob capacitor of the right value if you want to. Or you can make a phony capacitor by putting a stub of coax cable at that point. By choosing the right length of open-circuited, less than quarter wavelength long, coax cable, you'll make the highest Q, highest power handling capacitor you've ever seen if you use RG8 coax cable. So you're just putting a T-connector right at the antenna, or a little bit further back, depending on your calculation. And the T-connector, one terminal of the T-connector goes to the dipole, one terminal goes to the feed line going down to the shack, and the third terminal of the T-connector goes to this open-circuited coaxial stub, which simulates just the right amount of capacitance to cancel the inductance of the antenna, and now the combination is exactly 600 ohms. On the assumption now that you've got a way of properly feeding to 600 ohms down at the shack side, and the quickest way to do that, to feed it in a balanced manner, would be a half-wave coax balance. The half-wave coax balance is a 4-to-1 balance, and it's lossless. And it takes 50 ohms in and gives you 200 ohms out. Yes, 200 ohms out versus 600 ohms out is not quite right. But if you've got an antenna tuner, you'll handle that right away. And if you want to, you can readjust the length of the dipole to make it the right impedance so that at your transition point between the 4-to-1 coax balance and the 600 ohm line, you make it come out exactly 600 ohms resistive there. Again, with these curves and a little bit of smart, you adjust the length of the dipole just right, you adjust the length of the stub just right, and at your input end of the 600 ohm ladder line, you will see 200 ohms on the nose. And you run that 200 ohms into a 4-to-1 coax halfway balance made out of coax cable, and that in turn goes straight into the rig. And if you do your calculations right, and you can find out real fast if it's right with a standing wave ratio bridge or a bird 43 watt meter or whatever, you don't even need an antenna tuner. And now you've got perfect symmetric feed of the 600 ohm ladder line. You've got the lowest loss of transmission line that anybody in the New York City area has ever had. And it doesn't matter what is the height of the dipole above ground. You're correcting for it by adjusting length as far as impedance is concerned. So that is a sophisticated approach which has got the elegance of simplicity. By that I mean nothing expensive there. I will admit it's got a couple of slightly hairy calculations, but once you learn to do that, once you learn the skill of doing that impedance matching with nothing but length and a shunt capacitor, and you could try it all out by putting a phony capacitor there just while you're running low power to find out that how well it works. and then to make it a well weatherproof capacitor later on and take away your gimmick capacitor so you can really put a kilowatt into it, that's easy. You first want to prove to yourself that it works. And you can make a gimmick capacitor out of pieces of copper foil tape and pieces of paper tape. I've done it. I've made a phony capacitor across the center of a dipole at VHF frequencies by putting a piece of copper tape around one of the terminals of the center of the dipole and wrap a copper tape around the combination. And that makes a phony capacitor. And by standing off to one side with a thin little stick and bending the copper tape, it's a variable capacitor of high Q. It just can't tolerate a kilowatt of power. You put a kilowatt of power through that kind of a capacitor, and yes, you'll burn up the paper tape. But you just want to prove you can do it, and then you can substitute it with real components downrange. So once you learn that skill, once again, as I said before, you'll say, why the heck hasn't somebody told me this before? That is very elegant. No dollars involved. Just smarts. Just proper use of the materials that are already in your hands. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WB2HWW, with a question.
Go ahead, Howie.
When you're making the open-end cable, don't you have to make the shield just so you won't have leakage?
Negatory. A open end of coax cable, like RG8 cable, and you make it the right length to give you the right amount of capacitance, the far end of it will not radiate any signal until you get to at least 1296 megacycles. When I say it won't radiate any signal, the signal that comes squirting out of that open circuited end will be 55 to 75 dB down. And if you care about that, you can take out your Swiss Army knife and whittle that semiconductor back a little bit so that it's inside of the shield of the semiconductor, and now it's a completely shielded structure. Or you add another connector on the end where you've taken away the semiconductor of the connector, if you know what I mean, just to extend the shield. Once the semiconductor is hidden inside, it can't even radiate 75 dB down. It'll be a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff, and it'll be 100 dB down. An open-ended piece of coax. You'd be amazed how little that radiates. I know that's not like common sense. Common sense will tell you, hey, that looks like a fire hose. That are actually, however, roaring down the center of that cable should come squirting out of the end like no tomorrow, you would think. You run that experiment, you'll be amazed how well shielded that is. Back to you, Howie.
I know that. I just brought it up because when I make open-end cable, open-end stuff, I usually go into either, you know, if you want to do it the expensive way, I've done it both ways. You get a position open, or you just take a connector and take out the center pin. I've done it both ways. You know, you can buy the position Hewlett Packard, you know, open connectors. Those are very expensive. Or you make one just like you said, where you take the center pin out.
Yep. Your only real requirement for the end of the cable is to weatherproof it. You'd rather not have water crawl up that cable if it's foam-filled cable. If it's polyethylene cable, I wouldn't even worry about that. Put a dab of Celestic adhesive at the end to sort of weatherproof it if you want to. I'm not even sure you have to do that. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go to the next one if you'd like, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, I guess we covered that. Let's read some more here. Oh, here's a good one. This one is from Ben. Ben asked, what do you know about the... I hope I pronounced it right. Maybe it's T. Is that G-I-E-S-K-I-E-N-G? G-I-E-S-K-I-E-N-G. Antenna. Gee, I remember. I can't recall now. What was G-I-E-S-K-I-E-N-G? I remember something. There was something about this. But I don't remember. I think this was some antenna that came in somewhere from Norway or Sweden or someplace like that. Does that ring a bell in your thoughts, Dick? G-I-E-S-K-I-E-N-G antenna, over.
That's a new one on me, but I'm about to Google it. Golf India Echo Sierra Kilo India November Golf is what I think I heard you say.
G-I-E-S-K, another I, G-I-E-S-K-I-E-N-G, Geesk, Keying, I guess it's pronounced. Dick, got that over?
I've got that, and I'm about to Google it, because it's not a term I'm familiar with, and I'm rather skeptical I'm going to find that in the index of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, but I'm going to look in both places while you're talking.
What the heck do I remember about this antenna? Why it's the name, you know, that strange name for some reason jumped into my mind for a second, but it was different than something with, they did different with antennas, and something that had something to do with a dipole. I don't know. For some reason I remember something about something with phasing, something special about phasing with this antenna, that's all. What do you got on it, over?
Okay, I've got something called the Oboe Kilo 1 Romeo Romeo, and it's called, another look at something like that, a revolutionary addition to the low frequency band segment.
Ooh. Hey, that looks nice. Hey, I like that. I'm working on one of them right now. And I thought I got something unique. This guy's already done it. Hey, this is a beauty. Oh, boy. The second item, when you Google that word, is what I'm looking at. And I skipped down to the pictures. He's got some nice three-dimensional pictures of the field around the antenna. And, yeah. Oh, that looks like a beauty. I'm building one of these things right now for a client of mine. I'm doing it at UHF frequencies. He's doing it HF. And I was calling it a Texas Deer or a Longhorn antenna. And I was mounting it horizontal. He's taking the Longhorn. He's tilting the cow sideways. And a beautiful looking antenna. Okay. But I think I know what I'm seeing. I've got a guess as to what it is. And let me walk you into it slowly as to what my thinking is on this. Take a dipole that's out flat. We all know what that looks like. Start raising the center, and we call it an inverted V. And what happens if you keep raising the center and keep lowering the tips? You're making the apex angle sharper and sharper, and you could really make it two angles up there if you want to. In other words, you could make a little flat top section before it bends down of your inverted V, so it becomes an inverted U. And as you do that, even before you change the length of the dipole, you're slowly moving in the direction of making your dipole into what looks like ladder line. It's not 600 ohm ladder line, it's 1000 ohm ladder line. You're slowly moving in that direction. And if you did look at it as ladder line, because the dipole is on each side of the half of the dipole is a quarter wave long, you're building a chunk of ladder line a quarter wave long. And it's got a high impedance to it. The far end is open circuited, and you're feeding the input end a quarter wave away. An open circuit quarter wave away is nearly a short circuit. So the bottom line is, as you take a dipole that was flat out, and you start curving the ends toward each other, and you're making it into this great big V or U shape, the resistive component of impedance keeps going down. Take it all the way so that it looks like twin leads, and the resistive component goes to zero. So you can get any number of ohms you want with that technique. But the whole idea of a folded, of a inverted V is that it's an antenna that does not have nulls off the end. Broadside is purely horizontally polarized. End fire, it is purely vertically polarized. In between, it's some kind of a combination. Well, he's taking that concept of a high apex inverted V and mounting the whole thing, the plane of the antenna, perpendicular to the ground. The Longhorns are parallel to the ground, if you know what I mean. And that is an antenna that is broadside. It's vertically polarized everywhere. That is a vertically polarized antenna with its own built-in counterpoise and resonator. And because the length of the antenna is primarily parallel to the ground, if you built an 80-meter version of this,
you don't need 135 feet of altitude to do it with. I think you could do it very nicely with 30 feet of altitude. So it is a kind of a Texas Longhorn tilted on its side. That's what I see for the pictures. I haven't even read it. The guy's onto something here, Mel. That's a beauty. K2KEY. You got to go to that website. K2LIW in the TechNet.
HWW with a quick question, Dick, on it.
Yeah, go ahead, Howie.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you a silly question because I'm trying to visualize it in my head. Is it an inverted V laying on its side? It's laying down? It's like laying parallel to the Earth? Is that exactly what it is? With the feed line fed at the point?
Negatory. Take an inverted V and bring the ends very close to the ground so that it's a very steep angle inverted V. Look at the inverted V broadside, rotate it 90 degrees. So in other words, the plane of the inverted V is not parallel to the Earth. The plane of the inverted V antenna is perpendicular to the Earth. The apex is at the far left. The open ends of the inverted V are to the far right. And the whole inverted V plane is perpendicular to the ground. That is a purely vertically polarized antenna that is quasi-omnidirectional. He's got a plotted pattern here that makes it look perfectly omnidirectional. It's a vertical antenna that doesn't need a lot of vertical real estate. And yet it's not a high Q, heavily loaded structure. It's a beauty. I wonder if you get the picture, Howie.
All right. Question. One of the open ends close to the Earth, the other one is towards the sky. Is that what you're telling me?
Roger, Dodger. One of them is, both of the open ends, that piece of the inverted V, so to speak, are parallel to the ground, but one is much higher above the ground than the other. And you could say the apex is midway between the two on the left-hand side. Got the picture?
Yes, basically when you took an inverted V, you put it on its side. Am I correct in what I'm saying?
Yes, you are. And that's got a lot going for it. I haven't even read the article. I think the guy's on to something here, Howie. Mel, you got to see the article. K2KEY. I'm glad you got that email. K2LIW.
URL. I think somebody else wanted to make a comment. Go ahead.
I'm going to give you the URL. The URL that I'm looking at right now is whiskey1romeo.com/view.papahotelpapa?" And this is a tough one. This lack. I'm going to give it to you phonetically. After the question mark, Charlie, India, Sierra, Lima, Osco, Oscar, Charlie, Lima, Alpha, November, Kilo, Uniform, equal sign, and a great big number. The number is 2004122514. That's the whole URL. If you just simply Google the name Giesling Antenna, G-I-E-S-K-I-E-N-G, Antenna, simply Google that. The second item of the list you get is what I just read to you. QSL? Yeah, Roger, Dick.
K2RI, Dick, when you're making inverted V, what happens to the capacitance as the resistance goes down? Does that basically go down also because you're getting the ends closer together?
Negatory. If you're smart enough to do a little minor bit of adjusting of length as you bring the ends of the inverted V together, it stays resonant. The reactance can be made to stay zero. Only the resistive component goes down. As I say, it may take a little bit of readjusting, but you can make the resistance, you can make the reactance zero. Now, if you want to go one step further, this antenna will have a much lower impedance than 73 ohms. Although he's getting around that by feeding it in a funny way. He's not feeding it at the apex. He's feeding it at a point a little bit downrange from the apex. He's moved to the right He's put two extra bars in there, two vertical bars, and he's feeding that, and he's got exactly 50 ohms. Very crafty antenna. I've been building something close to this. I've been falling into it the hard way, and here this guy's already done it. I thought I had something unique. Oh, well. He's done it a little bit differently. But that's a nice antenna. Mel, you got to see this one. K2RIW.
So, Dick, you can actually see the inverted beam downrange from the apex. You don't have to short the apex. You just come up to the apex to an insulator. Then you feed your hot, you know, you feed your feed line on either side of the inverted beam through cross members.
Yeah, but he does have the apex shorted together. So my guess is the apex, which is looks like a 90-degree angle at the apex, that makes a isosceles triangle over to the feed point, so to speak. And the feed point is a vertical bar up, a vertical bar down, and the feed line right in the center, 50 ohms. So he's got the apex shorted together, and that is a kind of a balancing structure. Very crafty antenna. You got to see this website, Howie. Over to you, Howie.
You have to explain it to me, obviously. That's pretty interesting. He gets a DC grounded antenna, doesn't get static buildup, and he's using, coming off the hot end ground, or either the cable or whatever he's using, he's just going with horizontal, what I would call a cross member, to either side of the dipole, and he's somewhere off center to the antenna. He finds out wherever his 50-ohm feed point is. Now, what does his capacitance look like? Because you can get, you know, you can get the exact resistance. You know, you can find the right impedance point. What happens to the X of L and X of C in his antenna?
I'll bet you it's nothing. I'll bet you this is a one-to-one antenna, and I'll bet you it's even got a significant bandwidth to it. With a little bit of length of the so-called dipole, you can always make the reactive component go to zero. Any doubt on that, just take a look at Chapter 4, Antenna Engineering Handbook. Look at those two graphs for the monopoles, for all possible diameters, for all possible lengths. So making the reactants go to zero, no sweat. Even before, he doesn't even need tuning stubs. The antenna itself and minor adjustment of the length of the antenna is simultaneously the tuning stub. This thing's got a lot of elegance to it. It doesn't look like there's much there. There's a lot of smarts and elegance to this thing. K2KEY, that's a beauty. K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking this thing out. So what is he relying on here? In other words, is it relying on, a phase shift between magnetic and the electrical component of a radio wave? Is that what you would say it looks like, Dick? Over.
It has some of the characteristics of an extremely wide lateral line. It has some of the characteristics of a vertical dipole, except that the ends are bent parallel to the earth, upper end and lower end of the dipole. The apex of the dipole is a dead short circuit. Where the apex comes together, it's sort of a triangle with a 90-degree angle at the apex. So the triangle at the apex and the feed point, the upper rod and the lower rod from the feed point, constitutes an isosceles triangle, a vertical isosceles triangle. And then the upper rod parallel to the upper half of the dipole parallel to the ground, and the lower half of the dipole parallel to the ground, proceeds to the right from that point. The apex is to the left. Very crafty, vertically polarized antenna. I can have no reactants to it. He makes the lower half a little longer than the upper half. I'm not quite sure why. So it's a slight off-center feed. And I would have guessed the lower half would have a little bit more ground capacitance, and I would have made that shorter than longer. But he may have some reason to do that. I haven't read the article yet. But I see his plots of antenna patterns. They look beautiful. He's got both vertical and horizontal plots. Very close to an omnidirectional antenna. And let's say he's got more than one version here, where in one case he's feeding it in a rhombic-like structure. Cute. Oh, no, I guess that's, He's plotting voltage. All right, I'm just confusing that one. Pattern in one and voltage plotted in the other. Beautiful three-dimensional colored graph. This guy's no slouch. This is an antenna man. You got to see this article, Mel. Back to you.
We'll take a look at it tomorrow. This is K2KUY. Question. Can, how do I put this question? Separation of generation. Separate generation. That's the way, the right way to put it. Maybe. Separate generation of magnetic and an electrical field, and then control the phase shift. Is that possible, Dick, in an antenna? Over.
Sort of. Yeah, if you're smart enough with the way you build an antenna, you can arrange the radiating structure in three-dimensional space with all kinds of bends and slopes and curlicues and zigzags. By the way you arrange the metal of the radiating structure, you've got a moderate amount of freedom of what pattern you get. By adjusting length and the way you feed it, you can make the impedance anything you want, from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohms resistive, from minus 10,000 to plus 10,000 reactive, and anything in between. If you're smart enough, you've got the knobs in your hand to give you independent, complete control of the resistive component and the reactive component of an antenna. So within the antenna, does that mean you're controlling the E field and the H field? That's a bit of a stretch. In the reactive near field, in the volume of the antenna itself, this crazy zigzag thing you're putting into three-dimensional space, you're sort of asking, can you independently control the H field and the E field in that volume? I can't give you a yes on that. I'm not smart enough to say that it's possible. I think it is, but I ain't sure. But what happens in the reactive near field, in the volume of the antenna, almost doesn't matter. That's not where we dwell. Everybody you and I want to talk to is a mile away, 1,000 miles away, 10,000 miles away. They're in the far field of the antenna. What really gets radiated in space? And once you get a fraction of a mile from antenna, from the antenna, I don't care what your antenna is, you get a fraction of a mile from it, it is issuing a planar wave in space. And if your antenna is vertically polarized, the E field is directly up and down, perpendicular to the Earth, and the H field is directly parallel to the Earth, exactly 90 degrees between the two, and that wave front coming toward you is a perfectly flat sheet of energy. That's what gets radiated into space. How you do it, there's a zillion ways of doing it. 5,000 ways are shown inside that antenna engineering handbook. And if you're smart enough, you can make the impedance anything you want. To a certain degree, you can make the bandwidth pretty darn wide. And you can make the polarization in any direction you want to be whatever polarization you want if you're smart enough, in the way you zigzag your piece of radiating wire, if it's a piece of wire, and HF antenna. And once you start getting into VHF and UHF and microwave antennas, and you now can make things that are more like parabolic dishes and horns and hog horns and the cassegrains and Gregorians, oh boy, you can take all of the optical telescopes you've ever heard of, a refractor, a reflector, Cassegrain, Gregorian, I can't even think of the names, a Cuday feed mechanism and so on. Take anything you know in optics with telescopes and you can build a microwave version of it with no exception. The wavelength of Mother Nature from DC to gamma rays, the only thing that's changing is the frequency. Or conversely, I can say the only thing that's changing is the wavelength. And certain areas, the frequency is so high that your eye responds to it, and you and I call it light. And if it's longer in wavelength and lower in frequency, we call it infrared. And if it's higher in frequency and shorter in wavelength, we call it ultraviolet, and near ultraviolet, far ultraviolet, and X-ray, soft X-ray and hard X-ray. As you keep going down in frequency from infrared, you go to far infrared, and then you go to terahertz and gigahertz, and eventually hundreds of megahertz and so on, as you come down in frequency. It's all the same spectrum. Your eye responds to a certain portion of it. Your horn antenna responds to a certain portion of it. Your dipole antenna responds to a certain frequency range of it. That's what I mean by certain portion.